Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Life Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240 for Autumn Semester 2021. Today, risk return and the capital asset pricing model. This is kind of a wide-ranging lecture covering some odd territory. In the course of this lecture, there will be references to things that don't seem to have anything to do with finance whatsoever, but they are very directly part of the story of risk and return. As a predicate to that, however, having a quick look at the numbers for the day. Really? Let's try that again. Try it. Oh, I see. I'm doing it wrong. There. Having a quick look at the numbers for the day. Yes. Whoa, I guess that would help too. Thank you. The markets were fairly tame today. Interestingly enough, the Dow ended flat. The S&P 500 was up a little, and then the NASDAQ was up fairly handsomely. As you can see, whatever news was going on out there today is was much more favorable the smaller the company. The largest 30 companies of the earth were just like, it was, whatever. If you look interestingly at what happened, there was a downstroke. Do you see that downstroke? The markets really got spooked this morning. Most likely, that was the result of the more data pointing to high inflation coming at us, and also, by the end of the day, as you can see, the news turned around and there was a spike about midday, a little after midday, and then there wasn't really anything much left after that to write home about. Interestingly, I think every trader I've talked to this week kind of mentioned, nothing big, nothing on and on, but mentioned the possibility of war. Now, that is something that can cause markets to get very scared, but also keep in mind that war is actually very good for business. At least initially it is. More jobs, more production, a unifying cause for the country, the whole nine yards. So one way or the other, that doesn't seem to be moving the markets much now, but probably by the end of the year, you're going to see something that's dramatic enough that it'll catch your attention, something quite dramatic. And that's coming. But anyway, going over here, if you look at crude, sure enough, remember what I told you the next mark is, the next hurdle? It's at $90 a barrel. It's going to try to get there. But that's just the way it is. Turn this a little bit. But going on over, gold had a kind of a day, but there's nothing really big about that. Now, the 10-year bond, it skidded 3 basis points today. So the yield went down. That means that the price went up. The price went up because demand for bonds went up. There was a little bit of a portfolio adjustment, moving a little bit of money out of equities and buying bonds with them. And so the bond prices scooted up a little bit, and that brought the yields down a little bit. Now, bonds are, of course, a safe haven. There's not much risk of of a recession for some time. But when it comes, it will come hard and fast. And then you will see a flight to quality, bonds being bought at a very robust pace. But that's down the road, and the counter to that is that if the Fed clamps down on the money supply, that's going to cause the price of bonds to skyrocket. But On the other hand, though, that will also and the price of bonds in that case is interest rates. Real interest rates will rise. Expected inflation will be going through the roof. So you're going to have the risk-free rate, the basis of all rates, go way up. And that is, we've seen it before. And I'm going to even spend time in a lecture in a couple of weeks telling you about the last time it happened and how it's not history repeating itself, it's just history fulfilling the conditions of the time. That lecture will be optional. I will give a reading assignment if you do not want to come to that lecture, because there is some harsh language where I quote some of the officials of the time in which that last hyperinflation met up with a recession, so we got a stagflation. And that's a kind of a little bit of an adult lecture, so I will not require attendance at that one. And that way I won't hear another, get hauled in again to the office that covers people offending people's sensibilities. Anyway, enough of that. Now, I do this lecture starting out with some kind of odd side stories that don't sound like they have anything whatsoever to do with finance, but I promise you that they actually do. Oh, you, sir, you look like a very athletic guy. Okay? Yeah, you do. I know, right? No, it's like... But you see, you've been doing more and more push-ups and more. But then there came a time when you actually hit what you thought was one of your plateaus, but you never went beyond that. You were lifting. Dude, do you even lift? Yeah, okay. You lift. And you got it a couple of times, and you sound like you had constipation, but you got through it. But then there was a time when you hit a weight you could not get past it. You thought, well, this is some individual flaw in me. No. You see, there was this speed record for the mile. And it was someone actually got to 4. No one had got past that. No one, no matter how strong they were. But then recently, someone actually did a couple of times, but not much. Again, it appears that there's a human barrier in speed. Now we go into completely other things. When you get to car fuel efficiency, the first rules on getting mileage up, most car companies could do that with a little tweak here and there. And then the more stringent mileage requirements, fleet mileage, and the tweaks weren't quite what you would call it. They were having to actually move the technologies to get more fuel efficiency and changing the materials. And then they went up again and again, and the car company said, look, yes, we always cry when we get new regulations, but this is serious. We can't do this. We cannot do this. Not with existing technologies that we have. Come to another subject. Non-nuclear weapons. Well, you see, there's a thing that we want to have an explosive that is as small as possible, that creates as much boom as possible. Well, it seems that no matter how hard we try, there's sort of a limit to how much exothermic reaction we can get from any chemical we know of. Hence, we went to nuclear. We jumped the technology. But then we have a limit to how big a nuclear weapon can be. The Russians actually tested it, and they nearly split the fool planet in half, the idiots. It was called the Tsar Bomb. Okay, so now we're going to try quantum. Literally, quantum bombs would be planet crackers. They would destroy pieces of the solar system. Okay, that's another. We look at stars. There is a size that we never see any star bigger than. We just don't see it. There's no star that is larger than a certain diameter. Now, it's a huge diameter, no question about that. you could fit about 500 sun of our suns inside of a star that size, but we've never seen a star larger than that. These are all examples of what we call performance envelopes. An envelope is a barrier past which efficiency cannot be attained. An envelope is a barrier past which efficiency cannot be attained without a change in technology. And therein lies the problem. How do you change the technology? For example, the speed of light is a barrier. We cannot go faster than that. Never mind all the science fiction. Well, we go. Well, they do that. All you have to do is believe we can. Bull crap. You can't. You can't even get to the speed of light. The theory of relativity shows that, and we've seen it over and over again, the closer you get to it, the more massive the object gets to the point where you have infinite mass right before the speed of light. You can't do it. So we have to jump the technology. That's why we have the new engineering designs like the LQBL warp drive. It can fold space. It actually folds space so that we jump. We're not really going faster than the speed of light. We're just pulling a trick. But anyway, the point that I'm making there is that no matter where we go, in humans, in animals, genes, how many genes does an animal have? Well, some have millions, some have thousands, hundreds. We wanted to kind of figure, okay, there's probably this lower limit of how many genes an animal can have, a cell can have, and still be a functioning living thing. Maybe 200, 150. Well, not too long ago, we found one that had 35 genes. That's all it had. It had stripped itself down to an insane efficiency level. It's a parasite, and it actually sticks to other animals and uses their genetic machinery to do some of the things it has gotten rid of in its own genes. But 35. Obviously, there's a lower limit. You can't have a zero-gene animal. But the point there is, again, we see these limits all through nature. And that's an important thing for us in finance. Because in finance, we are always looking at the relationship between the risk of an investment, a stock, a bond, a project, whatever, and the return that we can expect from it. Is there a limit to how much return we can expect for a given level of risk? Again, is there a limit to the return that we can expect for a given level of risk? Put another way, is there a risk level below which we cannot go if we want a specific return? Like, for example, I want a return on my portfolio of 10%. How little risk do I have to take on to get it? Well, obviously, I could take on insane risk and maybe get it, but what I want in finance is efficiency. How little risk can I take on and get it? You drive like a blind trout, sir. I've seen you drive. You drive like a maniac. I mean, my God, I heard you saying warp six as you went past me. And someone in the back seat with a Scottish accent was saying, "Aye, Captain, fool. You could have killed us all." Now, here's the thing, though, is, well, you could take that return, the thrill, the efficiency of getting to your destination, but how little risk could you? Well, you can just drive like a blind trout, or you could drive like that but also wear a seat belt. You could drive like that and wear a safety seat belt and a shoulder harness. You could drive like that and also have a radar detector so you wouldn't run the risk of getting caught. See, there are a lot of things that you can do to mitigate risk, to lower it, to get it down. And that's what finance is all about. You want to make a high return? You tell me how ready you are to take the risk of that. I could tell you right now, you, madam, I can actually literally tell you how you could make about $1 million. In about 2 years. I could. Are you willing to take on the risk, though? That's the issue. You see, we know everyone has a risk tolerance level. You're a maniac. You'll take on all kinds of risk. You are a conservative person. You wouldn't take on much risk. You see, what we need to do in finance is know how much risk you're willing to take on. When I see these fund managers on TV, this guy had a return on his portfolio of 40% last year. Isn't he an incredible stud? He is not impressing me one bit because no one mentioned how much risk he took to get that. First of all, did he minimize the risk that he took to get that? Second of all, was that responsible to have that kind of risk given his client base? If he's got clients that are crazy, love risk, great. But if that's not the kind of clients he has, he should be fired. And he should probably be civilly prosecuted, maybe criminally prosecuted. You see, you have to know your risk preference. And also, when you hear about someone making a lot of money, no matter what it is, sports, stocks, anything, well, you have to say, okay, how much risk does it take to do that? And did they take too much risk? Or the least risk that they had to do what they did. So taking that as the background on this, you see, what we're doing is we are always seeking the performance envelope in our finance dealings. In everything we do, the world, the universe, always drives toward efficiency. And that's what we do in our business. So let me tell you a little bit about more about this. This is a little bit more generalized, and then it gets dead specific to finance because the underlying principle is there. I don't know. I'm going to tell you about your life. So, not the whole life. I mean, some of it's kind of embarrassing, but I mean the part about your health care costs over the course of your entire life. So let me switch my camera here because I forgot to start with here. You, sir, this is your life. This is time, and this is cost of your health care. Damn. You know what? I had to pull the camera back because I had only this area, and now I've got to reset everything. Just irritates the hell out of me. I mean, I long for the days of the green screens. Those were so much fun, unless you wore green that day, and then you looked really weird on stage. Dollar cost of health care against time. Yeah, there we go. Okay. You started out, you were born. You were kind of a sickly infant. Your neonatal health care costs were pretty high, but you got past that, and you were not too bad off at first. And then around your toddler years, there were a couple of little accidents. And then as you got into your later years, bicycle accident, vaccines had to be paid for, ear infections, and then there were some good times. And then you got to your adolescence, and you found out about girls. Then you found out about weed. And then you found out about something called Molly. And you found another girl named Tiffany. And then you fell down and got your act together. And your healthcare costs started calming down. And that's something that's fairly normal in your 20s. Do you remember when you were a kid, how often you had a snot nose or a sore throat or, you know, you just had more sick? And then when you get into your 20s like you are, you begin to feel healthier overall. At least most of the time, you don't remember. You're not barfing every other week or having diarrhea or things like that. You begin to develop some herd immunities to the usual childhood illnesses. And so things go pretty well in that period. Unless you get COVID because you don't want to get vaxxed or wear a mask properly. But then we get you into your 30s. There's the high blood pressure. You're okay. And then the high cholesterol. Then your diabetes and your heart attack. And then your Viagra. Then the kidneys. And then the Depends. And then you start getting really enfeebled. And thank God you finally die. That's your life. Now let's go over to you, madam. You were born pretty darn healthy. I mean, you came out swinging. You were pretty good. Of course, you developed quickly and you had some accidents pretty early. But you were in you broke a tooth at some point. And then when you were then you went into your teen years. And you found out about a guy named Nick. He drove a motorcycle. And then you found out about parties at college. And then you got into your 20s. And then you had a pregnancy. You had a cancer scare. And then you got out of that. You did have some high cholesterol and kidney problems, and you died later than he did. Women do live longer. There's a reason for that. We die early because we want to. Here we go. But here's the thing. Here's the thing about all this. If I put more and more people into this chart, they will start canceling out each other's peaks and troughs. And if I put hundreds and thousands of all ages, all through time, the overall healthcare cost of the pool of people will be almost perfectly predictable. And the more people I put in it, the more this cancellation effect happens. This is what was hilarious for all of the years and decades and centuries when insurance companies would discriminate against subpopulations, minorities or other people of color, gays and lesbians and all of that, and groups of other ethnicities and other countries. No, we don't want to insure them. You dumbasses, don't you understand that the more people you put in there, well, those people have that, a heart attack, but they also have lower risk of other illnesses. So the more you put in, no matter what, they reduce the risk of the pool. They do the canceling out effect. This isn't opinion. This isn't liberal and conservative. This is the reality of the universe itself. And it plays itself out all through the universe. And it plays itself out in finance in a very specific way. But let me tell you another story. Some years ago, high schools here and the middle schools don't have just a band. They have an orchestra, orchestras. And I think it's kind of cool because you can go to this orchestra, listen to their orchestral concerts. Well, I thought this was nice when I heard about it until that awful, awful day. When my fifth grade daughter said, "Daddy, I want to be in the orchestra." "Oh, God. And what do you want to play?" "The viola." "Mother of God, have you ever lived with someone who's learning how to play a stringed instrument? In other words, have you ever lived with someone who is taking you down to the seventh level of hell every day?"
My cats and I hid in my office. You know, mattresses on the walls to dampen the sound didn't work. It was rough. I mean, screeches and squawks and but then the worst of it happened. Daddy, we're having our Christmas concert. In other words, that sound multiplied by 400 stringed instruments. Oh, yeah. Well, I thought about killing myself, but I thought, no. I'd rather be in basic training again, but, you know, I'll go. And so here I'm sitting there in my sad little seat thinking about other things I could have done other than have children. And they all came out, first the fifth graders, and they all sat down. There must have been 100 of them. All of them holding stringed instruments, for God's sake, except for one twerp who had cymbals of all things. And they started doing their practice, sat down, doing their tuning, and it was just like, oh God. And here came the band, the orchestra director, fabulous woman. Tap, tap, tap. And I thought, here it goes. They started to play, and it was unbelievably good. It was damn beautiful. Why? Because they were canceling out each other's mistakes. With 100 of them, every time one hit a clinker, there were 40, 50, 60 others who didn't. And as it went on, this cancellation effect just carried forward. This is exactly how your AirPods, your noise cancellation headphones work. Every time it picks up an extraneous sound, it instantly creates a canceling sound, noise canceling. This is the same principle. And all through, you listen to these choirs singing, especially at Christmas, the Handel's Messiah, Hallelujah, and they sound great. Yeah, they're all, almost every one of them sucks as a singer. But you put them all together, and they're all, and the choir is amazing. This is that same cancellation effect going on. Now, I hope all of you know that when I'm not a professor, I'm an artist. And if you've looked at my work, you can tell that I'm an impressionist artist. Some years back, down in St. Louis, there's one of the greatest art museums you'll ever want to go to. It's just wonderful, and they were having an impressionist exhibit. And I took some kids down there, and seeing these impressionist works. And there was this one very bright, kind of just intelligent, curious girl. And she was right up next to this pretty well-known impressionist painting that was in their temporary display there. She was looking right at it. And I said, it's kind of pretty messy, isn't it? And she seemed a little puzzled and appalled that this was a famous painting. And she nodded her head. I said, come on, let's go. And I turned around. I said, don't look back until we get it. And I got her back about 20 feet, almost on the other side of that display room. I said, now turn around and look at it. What do you see? She said, it's beautiful. Yes. The chaos that you saw, all those messy colors scrambled around, you get back far enough, and there's your symphony. That's the way the universe works, too. You watch the birds flying, but then you see a flock of them spin in the air and do a twist and then fly on. That's art. You see the same thing across the universe, no matter where we go. We see the same principle. So when I show you this with stocks, it's nothing but a principle of the universe. This isn't an opinion. This isn't some theory. This is just how the universe works. Everything has, in stocks and bonds and securities, has two pieces of risk. Now, we measure overall risk by the standard deviation, sigma. And I'm sure you've seen it before. We can do it in Excel like a boss anytime we want. Matter of fact, I'll do one for you on Monday showing you measuring standard deviations as risk. But now remember that risk is variation in possible outcomes. That's what risk is. Risk is variation in possible outcomes. So your risk is determined by how many different meaningful, and I mean meaningfully different outcomes there could be.
on the one hand, you see, your life, you could be, you know, a famous actor. No. You could be a CEO, possibly. You could become a famous bad boy drug dealer. Probably not. You could become a street guy. Screw it all. I'm going to ask for money from people and stand on a corner. We'll look pretty and pathetic for money. But you see, so there's variations. But meaningfully, you're probably in a fairly narrow range of what's going to happen, unless you have some severe injury that changes the path a lot. So there's not a lot of risk with a lot of you. As you become more educated, the risk, the number of possible outcomes tends to diminish a lot. That's one of the powers of college, is that we know it reduces the possible outcomes. When I taught in prisons, we knew that with those kids getting education, a college degree, when they got out, the recidivism rate was just virtually zero, because we'd gotten them to a level where we could better predict that a good outcome of their lives would happen. And of course, then you add the idiotic, stupid-ass politician, well, maybe I'll have my kid commit crime so he gets a free education. Yes, yes, good for you. Anyway, but there's two parts to the risk in a security investment. You see, every security, except for riskless ones, has the pull of the markets on them. And it's some stocks, it's very strong. Some securities, stocks, bonds, whatever, it's very weak. But there's this pull that the market has. So that's one part of the risk. And then there is the standalone, peculiar, parochial risk of the company itself. So you could have, on the one hand, the market has a risk that is pulling on a company like Tesla. And then you have another risk that is a risk of the proprietor of Tesla, who is himself a rather mentally ill man, and many, many rumors are going around about him, especially after his performance last week. Very disturbing. But so those two parts of the risk. We cannot fix the world. You might want to, but you can't. You might dream of it, but it ain't going to happen. So you are at the mercy of the world. And that's a hard thing to face. If you ever saw, I could have give you a personal story, but if you ever saw the movie Lord of War, when the guy saw that there was going to be an execution and they couldn't, the one wanted to say, I'm going to stop this. He would just die doing that. See, so there is that part that we can't fix, the world. That's something that we can't make go away. It's just there. And then there's the part that we can fix in ourselves, in our communities, that we can make go down. Let me show you what that means in terms of stocks. I swear this is one of those almost philosophical lectures in a way, but it sets us up for what constitutes responsible investing, how you can be successful as an investor, or at least try to have a better chance of it. If this is our measure of risk, let's say standard deviation. Now, you've got to understand that standard deviation includes all risk, not just the world risk, market risk, but also that peculiar risk. Standard deviation doesn't discriminate. We have to do that on our own. And now, this is the number of stocks in your portfolio, or the number of securities, I should say. You don't have to have stocks. You could have bonds or other things. Okay, sigma. Now, if you buy one stock, that is going to carry a lot of risk. I don't care if that is a stock that is, well, this is a safe stock. If you have that on its own, it's going to be, this is standard deviation of expected returns. The expected returns are just going to be all over the freaking place, from day to day, week to week, month to month, year to year. Now, if you add another stock to that portfolio, the standard deviation of the portfolio's return goes down. And we've been doing these studies. This is one of those newbies in finance getting their dissertations. I've done this for decades, actually probably centuries. You put in another stock, and it goes down more. And the more stocks you put in, the more the risk of the return of the portfolio reduces. But it's reducing at a declining rate. In other words, if you want to be fancy about it, the first derivative is negative, the second derivative is negative as well. You see, what happens is that as you add more and more stocks, the risk of your portfolio keeps dropping. But it's asymptotic. You remember that asymptote, hyperbolas, they have that asymptotic. The more you add, the lower the risk goes, but it's going down at a lower and lower rate. Well, spank me, isn't that another performance envelope? A level of risk below which you cannot get with portfolio diversification. This is the non-diversifiable risk of the portfolio. Another word for this, you'll hear me call use, is systemic or systematic risk. It's the risk that inheres to the system itself. You see, ma'am, there are risks that I can remove. Measles, chicken pox, mumps, diphtheria, whooping cough. We can get rid of things like that. We can get rid of herpes, some of the hepatitis, and other things, illnesses, pneumonias in old people, shingles, things like that. But there are also risks that are just inherent to you being a human that we can't stop. Now, maybe we'll have the technology to stop cancer someday, but we'll still not create immortality. There's still a risk of you being you. Systemic in the system, systematic, non-diversifiable, that we cannot get rid of. As a matter of fact, we don't want to get rid of that because risk is how we get any return. You're not going to get any reward if you don't want to take any risk. Well, you get a little reward just for giving up your time. But you see, risk, we do want risk, but we don't want risk that is unnecessary. That's why when you buy one stock and think you're a freaking genius, I'm going to call you a dumbass. And that's not personal. Well, yeah, it is, because I'm that kind of person. But the bottom line is, you didn't need to take on that. Just like in those stocks. Now, let me show you this in another way. Now this one, I mean, this is so famous. It was back even in my time, you would see dissertations where the PhD wannabe newbie would do this data collection thing and do one of these graphs. And the whole point was to do more and more data points to see if it broke down or if it reinforced what we were seeing. And I mean, it never broke down. It was just one of those things where finally, I swear, on Google, I'm going to give you a term here in a minute. If you type in Google and say images, you're going to see this amazing thing. I mean, they'll have lots of these graphs. Some of them are weird looking, but okay, let me do this. If I graph which way do I want to do this? risk against return. And I just go and collect data on stocks. I'll collect one stock. There's its risk return point. Monthly returns, daily, whatever. Okay, I collected it, got another one. Got another data point for another stock or a bond or a project. And then I said, well, let's look at some portfolios of two stocks and three stocks and four stocks and other single stocks and just keep collecting these points and plotting them over and over for different sizes of portfolios, single stocks, multiple stocks, stocks and bonds, ETFs, mutual funds, whatever you want. And every time we do this, we see a performance envelope, a level of risk and return beyond which we never, ever see a portfolio or a single security get. It is always in this contained environment. The ones that were all the millions of portfolios and stuff inside are inefficient. The ones that would be on this are called efficient. The ones beyond it can't happen. They just aren't there. And if someone ever said, well, I know I've got it, well, you're something very special. We call this envelope, we have a name for this envelope in finance. We call this the frontier of efficient investments. The frontier of efficient investments. It is the boundary beyond which no risk-return relationship can happen. It is the boundary beyond which no risk-return relationship can happen. And like I said, you can Google this and look at images. Sometimes you get these weird flip charts and strange things, but this is a classic picture of it. It is just what it is. So you could say, well, yeah, well, I got this return that was 80%. I got a return here of 80%. Well, in fact, you could have gotten that same return with a lot less risk, probably. You see, the problem is that this is just like I was talking about before, which sounded very abstract. That efficient frontier is a theory. We don't see an actual portfolio anywhere on it. We can see portfolios that are extremely close, but that would be any portfolio along that frontier would have to have all of the securities of the world in it. And they would all have to be in it in their proportional contributions to the value of the world. So it's something that is theoretical. Now, you can get awfully, awfully darn close to it. Now, if you took my investments class, you get the S&P 500. You'd probably be about there, very close. And I teach a trick, it's not really a trick, but I teach a trick that if you get like four portfolios that are pretty close and you combine those into a single super portfolio, you get really close to the efficient frontier. So in other words, you buy four different highly diversified ETFs, for example. And you would be so close that, I mean, it would be indistinguishable from the frontier. Okay. Look at a company like Microsoft would be probably right about here. You buy it stock. You are taking on this risk level for this return. What that means is that you're an idiot if you buy just Microsoft for your portfolio. Because you see, I could get the same return for a lot less risk with a highly diversified portfolio. So in other words, this is the total risk of Microsoft. Look at this massive piece that is diversifiable. Risk. Only this small piece here is the non-diversifiable that you have to wear, that you have to take. The rest of it, you could diversify the portfolio and get rid of a bunch of that risk. You hold Microsoft on its own, there's your Uncle Bob, that's all of the risk that you don't have to take. Only this non-diversifiable part is necessary, can't be removed. The rest of that is nothing but that massive risk there. You drive like a blind trout, 100 miles an hour, but that's an extreme risk. Now, you could wear a seatbelt, a shoulder strap. You could have a radar detector to stop, keep police from catching you. You could do all those things to remove risk. So this is you driving at full risk when you don't have to, if you buy a single stock. Now, this portfolio diversification, let me give you a very quick heads up. Going back to that noise cancellation, you saw the two people with the different sick illness levels. Get out of the way of COVID. Okay. So what I will do now here is I'm going to show you that what we want to do is get I'll have to do it by a Google search. Every time I try to put my bookmarks on here, they get deleted that night. What you want are stocks that are not highly correlated. And the best one that I've found, here's one. Here it is, Portfolio Visualizer. Now, in this one, you type in stock symbols, and you say, okay, I want to put different stocks into this portfolio, into a portfolio I'm building. Okay. Well, let's look at, Netflix. I don't know, Ford. Apple. Kellogg, Tesla, anyone got any others? Which one? Okay, participation is down. Come on, there's got to be some more. Oh, Walmart? No, let me do... Walmart is WMT. No. Alphabet, Google, and MSFT. Good, thank you. Okay, so now we'll just let it ride. Here's the correlation matrix. Now, every trader, or rather investment advisor, analyst, professional, has his or her own threshold. Mine is 0.3. I say don't put two stocks in a portfolio if they have a correlation coefficient above 0.3 because you're not getting enough noise cancellation. So let's look. Netflix with itself, obviously, one. But Netflix with Ford, well, that kind of makes sense. They're in such different industries. They would be good together in a portfolio. Do you see that? 0.17. They're very poorly correlated, so they would cancel out a lot of each other's noise, a lot of each other's non-systematic, diversifiable risk. Again, interestingly, Apple and Netflix are very low correlation. Not even a surprise, Kellogg and Netflix. Now, you can't think to yourself, well, I can just figure this out without a correlation matrix. Not always. Sometimes things are thrown at you. Netflix and Tesla, yeah. Google and Netflix are very strange, and you'll see why in a minute. Ford is actually, do you see how Ford is actually pretty decent in any portfolio? It actually, Netflix is very good in any portfolio. Do you see how they don't fight, they don't run the same way as others? Now let's get down here to Apple. Oh, look at that. This one, kind of hard to figure this one out. Why are Kellogg and Apple fairly strongly correlated? Now, they're not awful. I mean, you could live with them, but why would you do that if you could get less with other combinations? The same with Apple and Tesla. Now, Google, there is no way I would put Google in a portfolio with Apple. Do you see that? Kellogg plays well except with Apple, and I still, that one, yeah. Tesla with Apple isn't a very good combination. If you go through here, Alphabet, look at this. Well, Apple with Microsoft, wow, that isn't hard to figure out at all. They're basically in the same business, so whither goes one's prospects, the other goes with it. See how highly correlated? You would never, ever want Microsoft and Apple in a portfolio together unless you had a lot of stocks in it. Then, yeah, maybe. But, I mean, look at down here. Google and Microsoft. No freaking way. Do you see that? So this helps shape how you are going to do a portfolio if you want to make your own portfolio. Now, getting over to this part, over to this side here. Do you notice that you're approaching this asymptotically? So in other words, there's no, you buy this number of stocks and all your non-systematic risk is gone. So how many would it take to be on the safe side with getting rid of that diversifiable risk? That would probably, I apologize, I did not show that to the audience, so I'm going to put it there for a few minutes, just a minute, so you can see those relationships in the live audience or the telecast audience. But while that's, they can look at that for a minute. So how many stocks would it take to clean up most of that diversifiable risk? Probably for diversification, ...30 stocks or bonds would get rid of about 95% of your non-systematic risk, your diversifiable risk. See, the problem with that is that first you would have to buy 30 stocks, all the research that would go into that. Then you would have to maintain the portfolio's balance. As prices moved against each other, you would have to adjust the portfolio to keep it so that they were in their proper weights in the portfolio. I mean, you can do it. There's no doubt about it. But you can also do it much more efficiently. One way is through ETFs or ETNs, electronically traded fund. An ETF is literally nothing but a shell of a company that owns a portfolio. So when you buy the stock of that company, you are buying a piece of that whole portfolio. So if you buy the S&P 500 spider ETF called SPY, we call them the spiders, you own the S&P 500. I guarantee you that no one in here, including me, could afford to buy all 500 of the 500 S&P stocks in the right balance for the portfolio. The ETF does that for you. That's what it does. You could buy an ETF for the S&P 500. You could buy, there are ETFs for all kinds of things, the Russells, the Wiltshires. There's an ETF for a couple of ETFs that are the NASDAQ. Can you imagine buying all the stocks of the NASDAQ, that vast ocean of small companies? There are even ETFs that create a structure that is mirroring the risk of a market. So if the risk goes up, the ETF goes up. If the risk of the market goes down, the ETF goes down. Or you can buy it the opposite way. So if it goes up, these things are very cool. Now, there's one other one. It's sort of, a lot like an ETF. They're called mutual funds. Now, mutual funds this is more like an ownership in a company that invests. So if you buy into the mutual fund, you are buying an ownership position of the fund. And so as the fund goes up in value, your share of the property, the fund, goes up. Now there are high load, no low load, and no load funds. A high load fund, you have to pay a big fee to join it. A low load, it's a somewhat modest fee. A no load, you don't pay. Now, my opinion has always been, you're a fool if you pay to join one of these funds because there are so many high quality no load funds out there. Why would you pay $10,000 just to have the privilege of being in a company with fancy people? But mutual funds, one thing about mutual funds, well, sometimes stocks pay a dividend. Well, you might get that dividend check, or they might just reinvest it and increase your ownership shares. You know, all kinds of different things. Now, one thing about mutual funds is they can be all kinds. I mean, you can buy straight up mutual funds, or you can do ones that are international, they invest only in international stocks, healthcare, green stocks. I mean, there's something for everyone in mutual funds. I strongly recommend that you don't do that because you're basically killing off some of your diversification. If you are in a mutual fund that invests only in healthcare companies, you've got to be seeing at least a lot of correlation between the stocks in that fund. So you want to be a little careful about specialization. But it is a very big field, and there are literally, there are at least tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of mutual funds. I mean, Fidelity, PIMCO, my mind is drawing a blank now. TIAA, CREF, every company has fund families of a couple, anywhere from a couple to a couple hundred. So, I mean, there's something for everybody in mutual funds. Now, let me show you something. Let me show you something here real quick. And let me take it off the share here. For ETFs. Give me a second here. Give me a There we go. Okay, so now, get everyone on the same page here, and I'm going to go back to Yeehaw Finance. Now, let me show you an ETF, and I've done this before, I know. Here's one, Spider. This is the S&P 500. Now, that's pretty, you know, $435 for one share. But if you think about it, you got the Standard Poor's 500. You got instant portfolio diversification, one. Two, you've got professional fund management by some place that's right there, in, probably in Manhattan somewhere, or near Wall Street. And also, they will be portfolio balancing every day, all the time. That's what they do. They are the fund managers. That's their job. So all you do is buy the fund, and you've got ultimate portfolio diversification. Now, look at this. Look at this here. Look at the beta. What do you see? Oh, it's the beta of the market portfolio. Well, duh. S&P 500 is 70% of the world. And so, yeah, it's going to have a perfect one. It's just going to ride up and down with the market. So that sort of takes the fun out of investing, though. I mean, there's something enjoyable about losing your shirt, taking guesses on bets on stock. This isn't any kind of a bet. And you'll see why on Monday that this kind of an investment is insanely good over the long run. Now, let me show you another one. This is a mutual, this is an ETF, but, oh, let me go back here. Let me show you what this, what S&P 500 has in it. Apple, Microsoft, Amazon, Facebook. This is basically FANG Plus. Now, do you know what FANG is? FANG is a term for Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, Google. The four big bad boys. FANG Plus puts some other big dogs in there with it. Look at this. Oh, here's Berkshire Hathaway. Let me show you something. Would you like to say that you own something that Warren Buffett owns? Berkshire Hathaway is Buffett's company. This is called a baby Berkshire. You can buy a baby Berkshire, and you're a shareholder. You get one vote for each of those shares on the board of directors, for each director. But what if I were to tell you that you could buy an adult Berk? Whoops. There's what one of those would cost you. You might want to save up your pennies. You're never going to own one of those. Neither am I. But if you buy that Spider, yes, you do. You own a Berk. I don't know if that was a Berk A or a Berk B, but boy, wouldn't it be nice? See, if you own one of those, you get to go to the shareholder meeting. You get to eat in the same room at the shareholders' dinner with Warren Buffett himself. I don't know that you would be wise to go up and have a selfie. Hold still, Warren. But, okay, now let me show you this one. This is a bond ETF. Look at this one. It has a beta of 1.2. These funds are so big that we use these as benchmarks for measuring the performance of other funds. AGG if you like bonds. SPY if you like stocks. But all this comes down to that last part, the capital asset pricing model itself. And I'll talk more about it on Monday, but here it is for you. We can write an actual mathematical relationship between expected return and risk. Using beta, the capital asset pricing model, the expected return to a stock or to a portfolio or whatever is a risk-free rate, because everything, it's got to pay you that, plus the beta of the security times the expected return to the market portfolio minus the risk-free rate. This right here is called the market premium over risk-free. This is your reward for taking risk instead of just a passive investment. If you look at the capital asset pricing model, beta is nothing but a magnification factor on the market premium. A beta that would be lower, below 1 would demagnify the market premium. A beta above 1 would magnify the market premium. This was our sort of pinnacle. Beta against expected return of a stock, the risk-free rate is 0. A beta of 1 is the expected return to the market. And so there's a linear relationship. This is called the securities market line. You tell me the beta of any stock, and I'll tell you what its expected return is. Beta of 0.5, it'd be right there. And you would have actual numbers in here. We can get all the numbers. We can actually forecast expected returns. It's mathematics. It's not opinion. It's not some guess. This is how it works. Now, see this equation right here? If you are ever thinking of getting a finance tattoo, you can't go wrong with this. Literally. I mean, this is it. I said once that I would give a bonus point to anyone who did it, and this kid was going to do it. So I've never said that again. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.